Welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth. Everyone is talking about the strange weather. We really had three winters in a row that kind of didn't really get off the ground in Anchorage. And this one is one of the weirdest yet. And one of the results of that is that we already have wildfires. We had a couple of them in the state. Had wildfires in February, which just seems really weird. As the spring progresses, it's going to get presumably, if it follows the trend we've got so far, it's going to get drier, and fire concern is going to increase. So that's our topic today on Hometown Alaska. We're going to be talking about wildfires in this very dry year that we've had here in Anchorage, and how you can prepare and how you can keep your property and your family safe. So I have three guests in the studio who are just the perfect folks to talk about this topic, and I'm going to introduce them and then give you the phone number and the email address where you can get on the air with us. Louise Foti is warning coordination meteorologist with the National Weather Service. That means she coordinates with the emergency agencies and makes sure that people have the information they need in case of emergencies. Thanks for being with us, Louise.
Thanks for having me.
Norm McDonald is a fire management officer. Covers Mat-Su in the Southwest. Big area. Thanks for being with us, Norm.
You bet. Thanks.
And right here in Anchorage, we're a unique city. We have a forester who is the wildfire mitigation coordinator with the Anchorage Fire Department. His name is John C. Thanks for being with us, John.
Thank you, Charles.
And John, you originally suggested this show, so I want to give you the chance to make the pitch of why this is an important topic for our listeners. But I want to also give out the phone numbers for folks who have questions, either weather questions or fire questions or questions about being prepared. Phone number here is 550-8433, 550-8433. Outside Anchorage, it's 888-353-5752. And if you get on with this by email, it's hometown@alaskapublic.org. Just click on today's show and you will reach us. So, John, why are you particularly concerned? What's the big deal this year?
Well, aside from the obvious risk, one of the things we've learned is that educating the public pays big dividends. Our wildfire mitigation program has been in existence for almost 15 years, and we've been able to reach out and work with about 1,500 homeowners in preparing their homes for the eventual wildfire. And that's treating the home ignition zone, the area right around the home, to prevent an initiating fire from igniting the home and then burning up the person's home.
Yeah, and I want to get into that in detail later on in the hour, but what is it about the weather that we're having right now that raises a special concern for you?
Well, the snowpack, lack of it, that I think is the biggest concern we have. And from several perspectives, one is it's going to mean that we're going to have an earlier start to the fire season, which we're already seeing. We've had, I think, five wildfires statewide now for 38 acres have burned. But the other thing is the vegetation hasn't been compressed. Normally, the snowpack compresses the vegetation, and a term in fire behavior we call the surface area to volume ratio, or the compactness of the fuels, really means that they're going to burn a lot hotter and spread faster. In simple terms.
And that's a very weird situation, isn't it? I mean, that we haven't even had enough snow to pack down the grass.
Yes.
So what you've got is sort of like a late fall dry grass that's just been desiccated for quite a while.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. So, Norm, what's the situation out in the valley? Is it somewhat similar to what we see in Anchorage?
Yeah, very similar from about Talkeetna south, where well below normal snowpack. And then you look at Palmer and Wasilla, and then parts of Anchorage where it's snow-free. We haven't had any really measurable snow since, I think, early January. So we've already had fires this, beginning in February. Most of them small, but, it doesn't take much in a community to burn something down. We had a escape burn barrel that burned somebody's garage down just last week. So the potential is definitely there.
Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of grass out in the valley, and it seems like fire probably runs across that really, really fast if it's dry like this.
It is. Yeah, like you said, it's cured from the frost in the fall and winter, and as John mentioned, it's all, you know, standing up, hasn't been compressed at all. So that just leads to, you know, a very easy start and then spread, especially if you get any winds at all. It doesn't take much to push a fire through that fuel type.
So is there a period of like a special danger until the grass greens up and then it is less danger?
It is. Well, once we get green up, that grass fire danger does diminish and go away. And then we transition to our, we call like our timber fires, the black spruce and the hardwoods. But our concern usually is, you know, most season I'll start first part of May through the third week, the end of May, and then start diminishing into June as we get, you know, the grass turns green and overtakes that dead dry grass. A year like this, you know, we're looking at grass season starting in March, which is a little early than we've normally seen.
Yeah, it is very strange. And I want to talk about sort of your experience with this year and last year. It seems like you've been through a series of tough years, but Louise Foti from the National Weather Service. So how unusual is this year that we're seeing? Is it pretty strange?
Yes, it is definitely unusual. Right now, we've had about 29.3 inches of snowfall for this season, which is about an inch more than we had for the entire last year. But you have to remember that last year was a record. So we are beating the record, not by very much. In terms of more snowfall, but the average that we have on a normal year would be about 80 inches. So we're not even close to half of that. So yes, it has been a very unusual year.
It seems like what snow we've had really hasn't stuck around as well. I mean, we get a little bit of snow and then it kind of melts. And so we have this phenomenon where, I mean, 29 inches, that sounds like a significant amount of snow, but there's never been anywhere near 29 inches of snow on the ground.
That's right. I mean, right now we're looking at about a trace out there. And I think normally this time of year, the max snow depth we would see in March is usually about, you know, 20 inches. So we're not even close to that as well. Even if we just had a couple inches, that would help keep those grasses down. But it's warm. And not only that, but without the snowpack, it actually helps contribute to it being warm. So it's almost this chicken and the egg type thing, or a vicious cycle, whatever you want to call it.
So in other words, the dry ground absorbs sort of more heat and sort of warms the place up, whereas if it was snowy, it would be sort of reflecting it?
Yes, that's exactly it. The snow will help reflect the solar radiation, but the dry ground absorbs it.
Interesting. Okay, well, it's Hometown Alaska. You've sort of heard our topic today. We're going to talk about this early fire season, and welcome your calls and questions about this topic. I'm interested in how you guys coordinate in terms of, you know, we have this whole red flag warning program, and I guess red flag warnings mean don't let any fires. I guess I don't know too much more about it than that. Is that your responsibility, Louise, to sort of figure out when you put the red flag up, or do you work with these guys, or how does that work?
Well, we do work with the fire agencies. And just to clarify a little bit, the red flag warning was something that we kind of developed in conjunction with the fire agencies to designate particularly dangerous fire weather. And that doesn't necessarily mean that it correlates directly to the number of starts, or that a fire that is started wouldn't be very impactful. I mean, you might have one fire that really impacts a region, but overall the conditions aren't that bad. So we should draw the line there. But what the Weather Service does is we're looking at the weather conditions that would contribute to dangerous fire conditions. And then we coordinate with the fire agencies, because the other part of that is the fuels. And so the fuels are, of course, your sticks, your grass, your trees. And they are the ones who understand the conditions of the fuel. So how those two things come together, and whether it's a dangerous fire situation or it's just kind of another normal, maybe dry day, that's how we make that decision. And we put out the warning so that the firefighters know.
So from your point of view, it would be like the humidity.
Humidity. Wind is a big one. In fact, both Miller's Reach and the Sockeye Fire last year were fueled by northerly winds. And so that has a big factor, particularly out in the valley and along the Kenai.
So, John, do you want to jump in on, like, what when it's a red flag warning, which means, like, be really careful with fire, what are you looking at?
Well, within the municipality, we establish our burning restrictions based on the adjective ratings, which is simply the fire danger. And we use the GRASS model before green up, as Norm was explaining. And then right after green up, we switch to a spruce model. But within...
So it's like a computer that's helping you figure this out? Or
well, it's a series of equations.
Oh,
basically,
really?
It's algorithms. And it's based on a system we're using that we adopted from the Canadians. It's their fire danger rating system. In the early 80s, we used the American system in Alaska, and we found that it was not predicting our fire danger very well. The only thing we had that really meant anything was the 1,000-hour fuel moisture, which would compare somewhat to our deeper duff layers. But in Alaska here, our vegetation and the decomposing litter at the ground surface, which actually burns, is called duff. And that material, it goes through quite an extensive drying cycle. So the first thing we have to input into that is our snow-free date. So as soon as the snow is completely free from the Anchorage Hillside, the Eagle River, Mat-Su Valley, then we start calculating fire danger indices.
So the earlier the breakup, the worse the fire season, essentially.
The fires tend to be more severe in seasons where they can get a much longer period before green up, yes.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So what does it mean, and either Norm or John, what does it mean when we say red flag warning exactly?
Well, for us, it's primarily we use that as a danger situation for the firefighters or the public. It's been when we get those conditions, those are where we've had our fatality fires. Mm-hmm. So for the firefighters, it's a heads up that it could be a dangerous day. Position yourselves correctly. Don't get in front of a fire. That's what we use it for. I think it's important to note too that we have and can and have had large fires without red flag warnings or days. A lot of the fires are fuel driven. The red flag is the weather side of it. So, just because there's not a red flag warning doesn't mean it might not be a big fire day. Usually for us, that indicates like the lower humidities and then, as was mentioned, the strong winds, which make things dangerous for the folks on the ground.
Well, let's get into like why fires get started. I mean, I'm sure you guys look at causes of fires where you can figure it out and sort of what are the biggest causes. And I know like way out in the bush, like lightning, right? But in talking about where our listeners are located, which is going to be Mat-Su, Anchorage, Kenai Peninsula, what are the main causes? Norm, do you want to take that first?
Yeah, for us, for the Mat-Su Valley and Anchorage and Kenai, we maybe like 5% of our fires are lightning fires. And then the rest are human caused, which, are all preventable fires. Mm-hmm. That's stuff we can stop. In the valley, it is a little bit different than Anchorage. We have burn barrels as a big cause. I think people are very used to going out and lighting their burn barrels and going to work and leaving them unattended. That seems to be a number one cause.
That seems
for
like
us.
A really bad idea.
Yeah, it is. And so we spend a lot
and
of time.
And the first house that's going to burn down, it's going to be your house, right? Do that.
So we do spend a lot of time trying to educate the public on that. And one of the new things for this year for the public to be aware of is in the past, a burn permit has not been required for a burn barrel. This year it is, which means you have to call before ignition. You call a hotline. It'll tell you whether it's an open or closed day or a safe day to burn. And so that's something that's new for this year that the listeners, at least in the valley, will have to adhere to.
Yeah. And we've got links on our website that I think will get you to that information. Just go to alaskapublic.org and prepare or click on today's show, which is Preparing for Extreme Spring Fire Danger. And thanks to our guests, we have a whole bunch of links, and you can find the information you need and how you can get that permit. So basically, what kind of fire can you have outdoors without a permit? Like we'll talk about the municipality, but outside the municipality.
Yeah, outside of Anchorage, it's a cooking and warming fire, so your campfires, as mm-hmm. long as they've got the ring and mineral soil around it, don't require a permit. what does is if you're doing the land clearing or brush clearing, so we call that our general permit, which you can pick up at any fire station. You can get it online. You can pick it up at forestry. And really the key to that is just calling in daily before you ignite. So our job on our end is to let people know when it's a safe day to burn, and then they have to follow the guidelines that are on the permit. So anything larger than your typical campfire where you're cooking hot dogs, if you're doing land clearing or brush clearing, that type of thing.
Burning garbage.
Yep, and that requires a permit. And then, you know, garbage is a, you know, that's a, we're talking about trees and woods and organic materials. If it's garbage, that's a DEC, you know, issue.
Oh, you need a different permit, right?
Well, yeah, or not, you know, or, take it someplace else.
Or no, you permit. Can't do it at all, yeah.
Correct.
So, but I mean, people do that. They just throw garbage in a barrel and burn it.
Yeah, there are, yeah.
Yeah. So what percentage would you say are like these fires getting out of control as opposed to fireworks? And I mean, Miller's Reach, people said was fireworks, but they never really nailed it down, right?
Yeah, that's never been confirmed. Mm-hmm. It was definitely suspected, but never confirmed on that one. And then this
last summer was fireworks, yes?
No.
Okay.
Yeah. No, that was basically an illegal burning.
Okay, that's right. Yeah. So what percentage falls on that illegal burning, and how much do you think on other causes? Like, because you read about all kinds of crazy causes, like a trailer that has a stuck hub or something and creates sparks and that lights a fire.
Our primary, you know, the human cause are kind of what you think, the burn barrels, the illegal burning, we call it burning without a permit. It's usually they don't have a good defensible space around what they're burning, or a mineral soil break. We've got the children, you know, the playing with matches, that type of thing. You know, there's power line fires during wind events has been, you know, it's a fairly common start. I think the ones that I feel are the most preventable are the burn piles. That's, you know, the burn barrels and burn piles. That's something that, you know, if you're burning on a day when you should and you have the water on site like you should and you're attending it like you should, you're not going to have a problem.
Right.
It's the people that, you know, light it, think it's safe, and then, you know, drive away for the weekend, and that's where you have your problems.
And so if people would just pay attention to the way they're supposed to do it, we would save a huge amount of money and a huge amount of heartache in fires. I mean, it's not like a marginal thing. It's a big thing.
It is, and there's really, it's you know, pretty cut and dry. You know, you need to have an adult on location with water and in attendance. And I think if, you know, people follow those simple guidelines and burn on the days when it's safe, you know, we wouldn't have the problems that we've had last year with sockeye as an example.
Yeah. John, what about in the municipality? What are the causes and what are the issues that you're most concerned about here?
Well, they pretty much echo the same causes that Norm mentioned. I want to make a point, though, that burn barrels are not allowed within the municipality. They were made illegal about 5 years ago, and they are no longer allowed for any use, including even burning brush. So that's really important. But we have experienced a little over 4% lightning-caused fires in the municipality, although it is pretty rare. Last summer, we did have a little bout with some dry lightning strikes, which did not result in any fires that we're aware of. Smoking is about a little over 10% of our problem. But I think the open burning thing, as Norm mentioned, that's kind of what we focused on is our number one problem. And it's, I think, one of the big problems we have discovered is it's people not in attendance of open fires, and either they start a fire and go inside to answer the phone or deal with something else. They just lose track of what's going on. So that is so important that when people do ignite any kind of open fire, they're in attendance 100% of the time.
Can we talk a little bit about weather again? I feel like, you know, when we're talking about weather and the fires, people also underestimate how quickly fires can get out of control when you have wind. And you might see the observation from another location, say, oh, it's not windy at Anchorage Airport, I can burn at my house. But if it's windy at your house, it doesn't matter whether it's windy at Anchorage Airport. That fire is going to be fueled by the extra wind coming in, and the wind also will dry it out, so it makes the conditions worse there. So, you know, you really need to pay attention to what's happening in your backyard, not just what's happening at observations around Anchorage.
So it's a matter of don't do it unless there's no wind? I mean, is that what you guys would say, that like smoke going straight up is what you want?
That's ideal, yes.
Our threshold in the municipality is 10 miles per hour. Once we hit predicted 11 miles per hour or greater, it becomes a no-burn day. And what I mean by no-burn day, we make a daily determination based on the forecast, and that's put out there on the webpage. On our links there, I've got it listed as, is today a burn day?
Mm-hmm.
The other thing you can do if you don't have
internet. There's a phone number, or, yeah, and that's on our site, too.
267-5020. You can call that number after 9 a.m. and find out if it's a burn day and if you're going to be allowed to have an open fire.
Yeah. Well, folks, you could just actually link today's show to your bookmarks, and you'll have this information at your fingertips, because we've got a bunch of links that cover pretty much all the information you'd want, and permits and finding out if you can burn and safe evacuations and getting information about a fire that's going on. Because once one of these fires gets going, it's such a huge crisis that really everybody wants information at once. And so that's a really helpful thing. Just go to alaskapublic.org and click on today's show, Preparing for Extreme Spring Fire Danger. And you'll find that, and also the phone numbers for getting on the air, which are 550-8433, Outside Anchorage, you can call toll-free 888-353-5752. And the email is hometown@alaskapublic.org. I'm interested in the big fires we had last year and how this year and last year, I mean, they seem kind of the same. I'm going to ask you to talk about that, Louise, and then maybe, Norm, you can get into what happened. And it sounds like we're sort of getting more and more into the same territory. I mean, we're sort of like, spring is getting earlier every year. We're getting drier weather. We're getting more fire weather. Louise, do you feel like that's true?
Well, I mean, we certainly have seen that for the past couple of years, this year and last year. The year prior, it was a lot closer to normal. That, what was it, 2013, 2014. So it's been a number of years since we've seen like a true normal year. We've had a number of climate drivers that have really affected the weather over the past couple years. So I'm not willing to say that we're into the new normal and now we're going to have fires in March every year, because I do think that as we move out of El Nino and we had unusually warm sea surface temperatures in the Gulf of Alaska, and that really affected our weather patterns. Those have also decreased. So as I think, as those climate drivers kind of shift to different scenarios, we're going to see a change in the weather pattern again. And at that point, hopefully we will get back towards normal and we'll be able to enjoy a typical Alaskan winter and have more a safe fire season. But
knocking on wood,
you know, I think with climate change, that's one of our real challenges here, is to know what's going to happen in the future. Because, you know, I never would have told you that we would have only had 25 inches of snow last year, but we did.
Yeah.
So, you know, as we go into the future, I think kind of all bets are off. But I am hoping that this is not going to be an every year occurrence.
Yeah. What was the situation last year when the Sockeye fire occurred?
Well, we had kind of the same scenario like you were talking about, where we didn't have much snow over the winter. The snowpack had gone away quite a bit earlier. And the conditions during that particular day weren't unusual for, I believe it started in late May. Is that right? Or am I getting it mixed up with another one?
Early June.
Okay. But the conditions weren't that unusual for that time period. It was kind of a sunny, nice day. We frequently get valley winds that will kick up during that kind of scenario where it's nice and warm. And that's basically what happened. We had those northerly valley winds that were about 20 miles an hour. And as soon as you get an unsupervised fire, if the fuels are already dry and ready to burn, the wind will just take it right away.
The wind does the rest of the work, yeah.
Yep, that's exactly.
And then it's really hard to fight a fire like that, right, Norm? I mean, because it's just going to whip along.
Yeah, that one, the combination of the fuel types and the wind, it made it, you know, really difficult. I think that's something that really back up what Louise is saying is that that north wind for us, you get associated with that cold front, and we get our lower humidities and the higher winds, and that's when we get our red flag warnings that time of year anyways.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of our watch outs. It was a similar pattern to what we had with the Miller's Reach fire and a couple of our other larger fires in the valley. So it's that when things start lining up like that, that's our typical kind of the watch out situation for me anyways, what I look at.
In Anchorage in the valley, usually when we have dry conditions, the wind will be more northerly. A lot of times, if we have more southerly winds, it's with a weather front coming through, and we might get precipitation with that. It tends to be a little more moist because, of course, it's coming up from the Gulf of Alaska. So, you know, not hands down, this is always the pattern that causes fires to light, but frequently we see that both in Anchorage and then also down on the Kenai, which has kind of similar conditions in terms of where they get their weather from.
Let's talk about the Sockeye fire a minute, Norm, because it seems like if you've never been around a forest fire, it's really hard to imagine just how scary it is and how disruptive it is to everybody's life. From your point of view, dealing with a fire around people's houses is a whole, fighting forest fire out in the bush is one thing, but when people's houses are involved, it's got to be a lot tougher. How that thing took off really quick, and did you have all the resources you needed? I mean, tell us sort of the story of how that developed.
We did, and I think we had the perfect scenario where it was the first fire of that fire bust of the season, and so we were able to get basically everything we asked for that first day. Within a matter of hours, we had four air tankers, we had five helicopters, we had the National Guard involved, we had three or four crews, and they were all there within that first shift, and we were not able to catch the fire. So there's conditions out there where even when we have all the tools and all the things we need, we're not going to be able to catch it.
You would almost never have a better situation than that.
Yeah. No, and that was a good example. They did good work. They saved a lot of homes and did the evacuations and things went safely. But I think our issue in Alaska is that second fire, which in this case was Card Street down in Kenai, and
right.
A lot of the resources had to come from the lower 48. So there's that time lag, and you can, a day of being short of resources can mean a lot of extra acres and potentially homes.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
I think all the more reason why we just stress, these human-caused fires are preventable, and we do a pretty good job getting to those fires and catching them small, but when the conditions line up like they were, it's even when you have everything you need, it's tough to catch.
How was the public in terms of dealing with that Sockeye fire? Did you find that people were cooperative? Did you have difficulties with telling people to leave and they don't leave? Or how did that work out?
No, they were, really good. A lot of people had been around during Miller's Reach, and, obviously they want to get the stuff out of their homes, and they have pets and dog teams. And I mean, it always amazes me to see how the community pulls together and people help out. And, it's kind of like the Alaska spirit. I think people went back in to help their neighbors get out and get dogs out, and their house was on fire, and they go to somebody whose wasn't. They're trying to help them save their what they have. So that's part of it. But our job as a public safety agency is to try to keep people from out of the way. And for the most part, people listen. The state troopers had a great response. Our cooperators with the borough fire departments was amazing, and we do a lot of training with those guys. That we did a lot of good work, but we always find things we can improve on, and that's kind of our mission for the spring is to. Any lessons learned we took away from that, improve on it, and be ready for the next one.
Yeah. Do you have anything you're thinking of in particular?
Communication is always a big one. We have a lot of different agencies with different frequencies, and you can get them all together. Trying to be able to communicate all together is doesn't matter where you go in the country, that's the issue.
Mm-hmm.
That's one that we'll work on for the spring. And then, a lot of it's just that meeting, we've got so much turnover between agencies, making sure we know who the right people to go to when we need assistance are.
Yeah. Well, we have a lot more to talk about on that topic. And I also want to talk about the hazard that we face in some parts of Anchorage, which look a little bit like the things we hear about down in California, where you have a wildland fire that interfaces with an area with a lot of homes, high value, and a lot of risk. And we're going to talk about that with our Anchorage forester, and a lot more to talk about in terms of how you protect your own property and how you prepare for this kind of one of the scariest kinds of natural disasters we have. But we're going to take a very short break. And when I come back, I'm going to reintroduce the guests and get back into the topic and give out those phone numbers for those who have questions or comments about the wildfire situation here in South Central Alaska. So stay with us as Hometown Alaska continues.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
It's Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth, and we are talking about fire danger. It's been a weird winter, not much snow, and as a result, the ground is very dry, and there's a lot of potential for it to catch fire, and it already has done so. So we need to be really careful. And also, there's a lot of ways to get prepared and to make sure that you, your home and your family is not in danger if a forest fire does get started. So got three guests in the studio to talk about this, and we'd love to hear from you as well. The phone number here is 550-8433, 550-8433. From outside Anchorage, it's 888-353-5752, and the email is hometown@alaskapublic.org. John C., you're the forester for the Anchorage Fire Department, and you work in wildfire mitigation. It's, you know, when we read about these horrendous fires in California where many, many homes burn, in some ways they sound like our Anchorage hillside where you have steep hills and lots of trees near homes and, you know, often high-value homes. What do you see when you look at that part of town? Is it concern you at all about the potential for a fire there?
Yes, absolutely, Charles. I think some of the similarities are the complex topography. By that, I mean we see chutes, chimneys, steep slopes, a lot of subdivisions where there's only one road in instead of two ways, possibly. So they share, and then the fuels, the grass, understory. We've had quite a bout with the spruce bark beetle in Anchorage. There's still a fair amount of fuel left over, and a lot of that has started to blow down. And I also want to mention that we're seeing another round of bark beetle activity.
Oh, is that right?
And saw quite a bit of evidence of that last fall. And one of our fire department captains was up north of Talkeetna over the last few days and reported back to me. He said he saw an area where there were thousands of trees that were just showing, the needles were turning red. So I expect to see a lot more bark beetle activity, both on the Kenai Peninsula, the Matsu Valley, and Anchorage hillsides as well.
So are those beetle kill trees more of a hazard when they're standing or when they've fallen?
Well, it's a little different. Certainly the first phase where the needles turn red, we worry about the moisture content in those needles may even be less than when the trees are live. But our spruce trees, white spruce and black spruce, both burn very readily. And one of the things we're worried about this season with the grass not being compressed and the higher flame lengths, it's going to transition into the tops of the trees and torch those trees much more readily. And once we get the fire into that third dimension, then it's going to pick up more of the wind flow, the general winds, and it'll push the fire even harder.
Then it can travel, yeah.
Yes.
So when is the period that you of maximum sort of hazard that you're thinking about? Is it kind of right now for that?
Well, it really can occur from, it's typically, I'd say, about April 1st on until we hit green up.
Mm-hmm.
And this year
it's early.
In this year, yeah, it's our snow-free is conditions are much earlier, so we're very concerned about it.
Mm-hmm. So I want to make sure we talk about how people sort of deal with that. Now we've scared them, how they prevent that hazard at their homes. But let's take a call from Paul, who's calling from Anchorage. Paul?
Hello. I was just wondering if you have any insight into the value of urban wetlands, especially like along the Greenbelt here in town, and the role it plays in the potential, or the role it could play in mitigating the spread of fire. Just thinking that there's a lot of usage down there, you know, encampments and that sort of thing. And if, fire gets spread, and if there isn't sufficient wetlands to break up the spread of fire, could that be a danger to us? I'm just wondering what you might have to say about that.
Yeah, the couple of topics there. One is that we do have these encampments around town, and then we have the a lot of parklands, which I assume are behave just like any wildlands anywhere. We don't have a ton of just open swamp here in Anchorage. And John, do you want to take that?
Yes, we do have problems annually with illegal camps. Chester Creek is one area. Last year we had an escape fire below Rogers Park, which was dangerously, occurred late in the afternoon as temperatures were starting to recover, and we had some humidity recovery. Otherwise, I think the fire would have spotted and traveled up the slope and compromised, certainly threatened several homes.
Well, you sure don't think of worrying about a wildfire in Rogers Park.
No, that's
right,
true.
In the middle of town, yeah.
So we have to deal with the illegal campfires that are mm-hmm. being set. We've had a plan in operation here. We work closely with Anchorage Police Department in locating and citing those individuals. But the main thing we do is get in there and extinguish, educate the people who are building these illegal fires, and then extinguish them.
Mm-hmm. Let's get into the topic of how you essentially protect yourself and protect your home. And I mean, one obviously is going to be paying attention to when there's fire danger. We've talked about that a little bit. But in terms of like keeping I've heard this phrase, defensible space, and maybe that's the same in the valley as it is here in Anchorage. Who wants to take that one?
Yeah, I mean, that's a statewide program we try to push. But yeah, really it is. It's just this is the time of year to do that. And as John mentioned earlier, pulling the wood piles away from the home. We like to see 30 feet of clearing around structures or homes, and then anything outside of that, limbing and thinning some of those trees out. And, that's something that the normal citizen can do on their own property to take action themselves. And there's a lot of information available on both the Anchorage and DOF websites on specs and standards. And if you live in Anchorage or the Valley, you can actually get a home visit and some ideas on what you can do to make your home fire safe.
So somebody will come out to your house and look around and say, do this, do that.
That's correct,
yeah.
Yes.
Oh, cool. How do they find out about that? I mean, is that among one of the links that we've put up on the site?
Yes. And
yeah.
Actually, there's a brochure, the FireWise Alaska brochure.
Oh, yeah. We've got that on the site. Yep.
They can click on that, the listeners, and mm-hmm. you can see the entire brochure. And if you go to page 4 of that brochure, there's a checklist the homeowner can use to walk around and kind of assess what their situation is. If they want to get some assistance, they can call Anchorage Fire Department. My number is 267-4902. We'll add you to the list. We haven't started doing those inspections, but we are going to start within the next couple of weeks. And you'll get a visit from probably one of our engine companies who will go out and do the assessment. And then
wow.
We also provide
fire truck pulls up to your house.
That's right.
That would be great for the kids.
Well, and it's a two-way education experience. Uh-huh. Our crews are learning more about the wildland component around some of our Anchorage neighborhoods. So it's good for both the homeowner and the firefighters.
So what is the, I mean, how many people are doing this? I mean, let's start with you, Norm. You cover the Mat-Su. When you had this sockeye fire, did you find that most people had taken that advice and had that 30 feet around their homes?
I think, the further you get away from Anchorage, there's probably people moving out to the outskirts that are there for a reason, and they haven't taken that advice. It takes something like sockeye to, remind people that there's a potential for fire in Alaska. I will say after sockeye, there's a lot of homes out there that now have defensible space that didn't, a year ago. So I guess one of the, things you get out of a large fire reminds you it can happen. You look across the highway, what happened to your neighbors, and people are clearing a lot of land out there. And that's something we try to promote throughout the state. One of the things I think, people have to realize as you get further away from the hubs, Anchorage and Fairbanks, there's not going to be a fire truck in every driveway for every fire. So it's kind of the responsibility of the homeowner to be prepared for that. So there's a lot of good information. We have people that go out and do home visits as well. And, we really try to stress that, people should, the homeowners should take action on their own property and be as proactive as they can with that. And we'll help out where we can, providing input and information, but it really does come down to the homeowner to make that decision.
So if you're in a fire, like you mentioned, and there's a 25 mile an hour wind, I wouldn't think 30 feet would do you a heck of a lot of good.
Well, it gives you, you're a lot better place than you would be if you didn't have that.
If you had none, right?
Yeah. I mean, ideally you'd like to have more, but, usually the fires, what we would like to happen in that scenario is they come out of the trees and are onto the ground where a fire truck or a firefighter can fight the fire while it's on the ground. But if it's, in the canopy of the trees and, then it's pretty much unstoppable. So our, with this FireWise, that's the objective there, is to get that fire out of the canopy and onto the ground where you can fight it, or even a homeowner with a hose can do something.
A lot of people, and everybody remembers Martin, I think it was Martin Boozer during the Miller's Reach fire, stayed home and fought the fire himself and stuff like that. And when I think about like a fire at my cabin or something, I think, oh no, I'd stay here and fight the fire myself with a hose. Is that, what do you guys think about that? I mean, I think a lot of people would want to do that.
Yeah, there are. And, I just look at it for as myself, would I stay or go? And I've got a family and children, and I can rebuild my house if it's something that I can put myself in jeopardy. Mm-hmm. I'm going to make the right decision for my family and probably leave. But, it is a decision that if you're an adult and you can, make that decision for yourself. We recommend strongly that if you're being told to evacuate, there's a reason for that, and you should take that advice.
John, do you want to weigh in on that one?
Well, I think it's really important to deal with wildfire mitigation ahead of time, thinking that you're going to drop trees and, get rid of the hazard in the last hour before you have to leave.
Probably not going to work.
Isn't realistic, and I know Norm would probably echo this. We've seen that on numerous fires that our team has responded to, and it doesn't work very well. So people need to be thinking about it now, this spring. We've got woodlots where people can take their woody debris. The one at the landfill, Eagle River Landfill, is free on Fridays and Saturdays. I believe it's 8 to 6 p.m. they can take their debris. South Anchorage at 100th and C Street is a privately operated woodlot. They charge $15 a load, but they're doing a great job in mitigating that hazardous fuel. And I might add that all that woody debris gets chipped up and recycled. It's used at our landfill for daily refuse cover. So it helps actually the garbage break down faster. It gets covered with a layer of chips, and it also keeps the bird problem down to a minimum.
Okay.
And the odor as well. So
you're multitasking.
Yeah, yes. It's a great compliments what we're doing with FireWise.
Cool. So I want to, we've got about 15 minutes left, and I've got a bunch more I want to talk about, including what we could do should we have fire breaks in the community? And what about roofing materials? And also, do we have enough resources to deal with these fires? And what can we look for in the future? Is it, you know, what's the long-term climate forecast? So we're going to get to all that. But if you want to get on the air with us, we welcome your calls. The number is 550-8433. It's 550-8433. Outside Anchorage, it's 888-353-5752. And the email is hometown@alaskapublic.org. And we'll just get those emails right here in the studio and read them to our guests. So got three guests in the studio. John C. is the forester for the Anchorage Fire Department. Norm McDonald is a fire management officer for DNR out in Mat-Su in the southwest part of Alaska. And Louise Foti with National Weather Service is a warning coordination meteorologist. Louise, what is the climate outlook? I mean, I don't know how far in the future you can really predict, but are we going to be having a really warm summer? Is that something you can sort of say, well, there's a higher percentage probability of that than not, or how does that work?
Well, you kind of spoke to it a little bit. We do kind of these percentage probability forecasts for up to about 3 months out. Right now, it does look like there is a pretty good chance of above normal temperatures here in the valley and in Anchorage. How far above normal? We don't have those sorts of numbers available. So it could only be a couple degrees above normal, but it could also be, you know, even 5 degrees average above normal. We just don't know. In terms of precipitation, it does look like we might get some precipitation along the coast. But here in Anchorage and up towards the valley, equal chances of above normal or normal precipitation. Something we need to remember, though, is that we're starting to get into a dry period. So on average, April, May, and June are not excessively wet anyway. So when we say it might be normal precipitation for that time period, we're not expecting huge amounts of rainfall. So we expect, you know, pretty dry conditions to continue into the summer.
One of the driest parts of the year, yeah.
Exactly.
So does that kind of prediction affect you guys in terms of your resources, or you just have whatever the norm, you just have whatever the legislature gave you, and that's what you go with?
We do. We have the ability to bring resources in from the lower 48 in Canada. Mm-hmm. We have agreements, you know, with a lot of different agencies. And when the conditions are creeping into that extreme, you know, we start pulling resources in to augment what we have. But for, you know, the day-to-day operations, we have what we get. I mean, we're well aware of the potential for a dry season and an early season, but we prepare for the worst every year. So, you know, we don't prepare any differently for a year like this than a year with a lot of snow.
Is the state budget crisis affecting you guys at all?
I think last year it was difficult to deal with at first. It had, you know, happened right as our fire season was starting. So we were really trying to figure out how we were going to reorganize and take that on. With a winter to plan and kind of reorganize and streamline some things, I think we're in a okay spot right now.
Mm-hmm. You closed down a center out in McGrath, right?
We did, and that's the Mat-Su office, which I'm responsible for, ended up taking the Southwest over. So it's an additional 88 million acres we're protecting out there, for which includes private, all Native, and federal lands as well. So it's a big job. You know, last year was the biggest fire season they had on record in southwestern Alaska, with over 120 starts. So we were spread very thin, but, you know, we're taking steps to be able to at least get an initial attack in and have people available and call people in from lower 48 or Canada, mm-hmm. as we need to augment our resources.
And John, from the point of view of Anchorage, you guys jump in and help sometimes too, right?
Yes, that's right. We provide, last year we had, I think, two task forces that went up to the Sockeye Fire and helped with structure protection. We also worked on the Funny River Fire the year before that.
So do those local governments sort of pay us back for that, or is Anchorage taxpayers, or we just figure, well, if we need help from them, they'll help us next time?
Well, they do. They do pay us back, and it's supposed to be to help cover our operating cost, but the important thing there is we work together to help each other. There are times when Anchorage is going to rely heavily on Division of Forestry to cover our backs when we have an escaping fire, possibly on the hillside or Eagle River. So it's very important that we work together.
Mm-hmm. All right, we've got a call from Janet in Anchorage. Janet?
Yes. Hi, Charles. Thank you for taking my call. My concern is that I live near Baxter Bog, and every year around about July 4th, when it gets dark, there are firecrackers and rockets taking off. And this is all around the bog. It happens every single year. I know it's against the law to have fireworks, but that doesn't stop people. And so my concern is that the parks need to be monitored on that evening of July the 4th. All parks should, because it's just going to continue unless it's enforced and unless people are arrested. It's just going to continue. And it's so dry. I even see people, evidence of firecrackers all around the path in the park. So I just want to know what to do about it.
Yeah. Well, let's turn to John from the Anchorage Fire Department.
Well, last summer we adopted a zero tolerance approach to fireworks, and I think it was the quietest 4th of July in Anchorage that at least our fire department dispatchers, some with several decades of experience, remarked that they had never seen a quieter 4th. So I think that that probably is how we're going to handle it in the future. But, you know, it really comes down to educating the public and asking for their cooperation. We can have fines, and we do the policy we had last summer was we confiscated and fined on the initial contact. There were no warnings, but the great thing about it was there were very few fines that were actually required.
Maybe people were scared of getting fined.
They got the message, yeah. And it was quiet. But you know, if we can save a several million dollar fire that mm-hmm. could potentially burn homes, you know, it's a great thing.
Yeah. And fireworks are a big issue out in Mat-Su as well, and they're still legal in Houston, I think, right? Do they still have those stands up there?
Yeah, there are stands in Houston, and then, you know, and it's a trooper enforcement issue for us, unless a fire starts, but you know, as a cause of a fire. But
It seems obvious that would be a really bad idea when there's a lot of dry grass around. Is it as common a fire source as you would think it would be?
You know, we get several a year from fireworks. You know, I think our primary cause, though, is if we're going to try mm-hmm. to eliminate one fire cause, it's the debris burning and burn barrels. That's mm-hmm. the majority of our starts come from that.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks, Janet. Good question.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
I would want to talk about weather one more time. Louise, I'm always saying this. I've got to stop myself. But when I was a boy in Anchorage, lightning was unknown. I mean, it was very, very rare, and it seems like it's become more common. Am I right about that? That lightning is more common in South Central Alaska than it used to be?
You know, that's a really tough question to answer, and part of the reason for that is that lightning is not frequently observed at Anchorage Airport, which is one of the few locations that does observe lightning. A lot of our other observations in town actually don't observe lightning, so we're relying on comments from the public. So the question then is, are people moving further out from the center of Anchorage and closer to the mountains, which is where we do see lightning, or is it happening more frequently? And there it's probably a little bit of both, but we don't have actual statistics on it. So mostly at this point, it's people like yourself saying, well, I don't remember ever having lightning storms, and now we have them.
Mm-hmm. And they happen when the weather gets particularly warm, and so you get these convection movements happening, right? And that might be something we're getting more of.
That's right. I mean, it does happen with warm temperatures, and we are having warmer conditions. It also requires humidity. So on these really dry days, we don't see thunderstorms quite as frequently. There's other factors involved, of course. Number of lightning strikes can make a big difference on how many fires are ignited.
Mm-hmm. So I wanted, before we're totally done, I wanted to ask about the way people build homes. You know, when you think, John, about the hillside, a lot of very nice homes there, some of them still with cedar shake roofs, which seems like that would be a hazard. Is there a way that you could build your home if you're in the woods that would make it safer in case of fire, as opposed to, you know, what you might build in like a Turnagain?
Yes, and that's the first thing to stay away from is wood shake roofs. There is no way we can protect a structure with a shake roof. There's no way to treat the wood shake shingles. But the main thing is we want to see folks remove spruce trees from a radius of about 15 feet. And then beyond that, out to 30 feet or a little more, prune the lower limbs so that if we do see a surface fire, embers land and catch this grass on fire, it doesn't cause the spruce trees to torch. Wooden walkways are a problem. Another big thing Alaskans do is they like to put their firewood under the deck.
Yep.
We want to see it 30 feet away from the structure.
Then on those cold nights when you got to go get a piece
that's
of wood,
right.
You got
to walk. Now, I will qualify that. If you want to move some of the wood closer, put it under the deck, just have it burned up by the time fire season
starts.
There
you go. One winter's worth.
Yes.
Okay.
And then snow machines, gas cans, even lawnmowers right next to the home. People like to put those under the eaves. And unfortunately, embers can get that plastic gas tank going.
Very easily.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
So those are all things that we'll pick up on these free home inspections if the public asks for those.
Right.
We do those.
And for those folks who are just tuning in, you can go to alaskapublic.org and you can find many, many links on today's show, which is headlined Preparing for Extreme Spring Fire Danger. Tons of links for you to get the information you need to prepare and to be safe. The caller that we had previously was asking about wetlands, and I don't know if there's anything we can do from a community planning standpoint, especially in these areas you're talking about, like on the hillside where you have these steep hills where we could maybe have fire breaks or something. Do you guys look at that, John?
Well, we've worked with Division of Forestry to construct some fuel breaks. We did a shaded fuel break at the base of Stuckigan Heights area. That was in conjunction with the hotshot crew and forestry firefighters from Palmer.
So you are doing that.
Yes, right. We are.
All
yes.
Right. Well, I want to thank all three of my guests for being here. John C., you were just hearing from the Anchorage Fire Department. He's the forester and wildfire mitigation coordinator. Thanks, John.
You're welcome.
And Norm McDonald, fire management officer with Division of Forestry and covers MATSU in Southwest Alaska. Thanks for being here, Norm.
Yeah, thank you.
And Louise Foti from the National Weather Service, a warning coordinating meteorologist. Thanks for being here, Louise.
Thank you for inviting me.
Next week, Kathleen McCoy will be your host, and she's going to be talking about the Alaska justice system. We're going to try a new thing here where we have discussions about justice every few weeks on Hometown Alaska. So that's what you can tune in for. Join us next week. I'm Charles Wolforth, and thanks for listening to Hometown Alaska.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.